This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Every people, every nation has a story about its origins, about how they or it came to be. And because those stories can get spread far and wide, because they profoundly influence how people think of themselves and others, it makes sense to examine them, to put them under a microscope, and if one is found wanting, to see if another narrative makes more sense. Let's take the mainstream origin story of the U.S. White Europeans arrived in the New World, they tamed the landscape, and they tamed and did their best to civilize the natives. Well, what if that origin story were replaced by a story told by Native Americans? And what if we could use an extraordinary woman named Sarah Winnemucca, born in the 1840s, as the source of a vision of equality and mutual responsibility that could guide relations between whites and Native communities? Carrie Carpenter has written an essay about Winnemucca and the way in which she contested both America's founding narrative and the myth of the vanishing Indian. That essay is part of the new volume, Racially Writing the Republic, Racists, Race Rebels, and Transformations of American Identity, edited by Bruce Baum and Duchess Harris. Carrie Carpenter is an assistant professor of English at West Virginia University and the author of Seeing Red, Anger, Sentimentality, and American Indians. When I spoke to Carrie Carpenter about Sarah Winnemucca, who grew up in what's now Nevada, I asked about Winnemucca's parents and early life.
Well, she basically was born at a really interesting time in Paiute history and in Native American Anglo history in general. She was born at the point at which there was increasing amounts of exploration by Anglos in the area. And, of course, 1844 was the year of the Donner Party. So that was something that she was aware of and very much influenced as an individual and as a tribal member by that exploration or colonization, as we should probably say. Her family was important, although some people today in the tribe have some critique about the degree to which people have thought that her father and grandfather were sort of the preeminent people in the tribe. So it's kind of complicated about what her role or her family's role actually was in the area. It was definitely prominent, but it's not clear exactly how much of that was perception versus reality.
Sarah Winnemucca at some point began working for white families. What kind of work did she do, and what did she pick up as far as language skills?
Well, she was really quite talented with languages. She spoke several languages and learned English relatively young. She was sent to live with a white family in Genoa and was doing, it was pretty common to have natives sent to work in white households doing household sort of work and labor. And it was there that she picked up English. And there's a story about her going to school there in the area, but then parents actually requiring that she not attend the school anymore because they were offended by the thought of a Native American child going to school with white kids. But she did pick up English at that point, and she also spoke Shoshone and others. So she was able to go and actually be an interpreter, which really helped her out later on. She was able to make money in ways that other people of the tribe were sometimes limited by because she had those language skills. So she became a very important interpreter.
Who was she engaged as an interpreter by? Who employed her?
She worked for the U.S. Army, being asked to encourage different Native groups to go to a particular reservation or that sort of thing. And so you can see why some people at the time and even today critique her for being on the wrong side of things or on the white side of things, because she was perceived by some as encouraging the reservation system or something like that. But it was usually that she was employed by agents of the U.S. government to interpret into English the Native dialects.
Let's turn to Truckee, who you said was Sarah Winnemucca's grandfather.
Right.
What, according to Winnemucca, did Truckee believe about the original composition of the Paiutes and what happened to them?
He was drawing from some of the traditional stories, and I think it makes a lot of sense, as I say in the article, that people show up that you don't know their origin, you don't know their history. It only makes sense that, of course, you're going to try to fill that in with some narratives from your own culture. So he basically did that and took a story that there had been many like this, but he took one talking about how the Paiutes had originally been made up of two races, basically two dark and two white children, and then at some point a vicious quarrel came about between them and they were separated, and then he basically interpreted the whites' reappearance in the 1840s as the return of this original pair of white siblings. So for him then, it was not, I think, perceived as a horrible thing that these people were coming into the area. It was a return of a sort of family member.
So in other words, again, the idea was that we had two dark and two white children. Mm-hmm. They were separated. And then so then the whites appearing in this region, in this area in the 1840s were considered by Truckee to be the returning white children.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. As he said, something like, my long looked for white brothers have come at last. And so really thought of it as a moment of celebration to welcome them back into the family, basically, which was, I think it's important to say, this is not necessarily the viewpoint of all Northern Paiutes. I think many were quite disturbed and troubled and fearful about the arrival of these people. But in Winnemucca's narrative, she's sort of retelling this as the voice of one person who was a leader among the Paiutes. So that was one of the more prominent narratives, I think, that got told.
You argue that Winnemucca's account of her grandfather's story constitutes, quote, an alternative origin story of the U.S. What does that mean?
Basically, that thinking about Native American literature, that they, of course, like all cultures, have founding narratives that explain how they got to be where they are, how the geography was formed, how the people were formed. And I think it's interesting to look at, to kind of put her narrative through her grandfather's narrative at the center of some of these discussions of American studies, because I think what happens is that sometimes we end up retelling the same old story, which is of the Plymouth Rock, the arrival of whites, and the decimation that occurred, which is true, of course, but it's told in a very sort of one-way sort of dynamic. And I think by putting this narrative at the center, we can sort of rethink how those early narratives might have been told, or how we understand how America came to be, or what America actually is.
What do you like most about this origin story? Again, this is Sarah Winnemucca's version of her grandfather's origin story as related in her 1883 book, Life Among the Paiutes, Their Wrongs and Claims. What appeals to you about this story as opposed to the mainstream story?
Well, I really like the idea that it's seen as a sort of kinship model, that there is an equality there between rendering the two dark children and the two white children, instead of, as is usually perceived, a lot of the language of the founding days of the U.S. is the sort of parental description of the, you know, the parents as whites and the children as natives, and going along with that, a sort of, you know, simplification then of natives and kind of a rendering of them as juveniles or children. And I think this way really forces us to look at them more as equals and as people that have kinship responsibilities to each other. And I love the way she actually poses statements in her book directly to people like the president of the U.S. and really takes him to task for having this kind of language about Plymouth Rock and civilization and all of that, and shows how the whites have basically fallen in terms of their responsibilities of kinship, that they really are not fulfilling their obligations as family members, as equals.
Carrie Carpenter is an assistant professor of English at West Virginia University. We're talking about her essay entitled Sarah Winnemucca and the Rewriting of Nation in the new volume Racially Writing the Republic, Racists, Race Rebels, and Transformations of American Identity. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song. In her book, and this is again the 1883 book, Life Among the Paiutes, Sarah Winnemucca refers to two races, the inheritor and the invader. Who do these categories refer to?
Right, the inheritor as having kind of ownership over the nation in some ways. And I think that's something that many narratives of the U.S. don't take into account. It's thought of as empty land or as land that's not owned, that natives don't have a concept of property, that sort of thing. And when we think about it in terms of natives as inheritors, as rightful owners, then it becomes a very different sort of narrative. And you have to think about how the whites are then coming in as not as the owners, as sort of returning children who need to then recognize that the natives occupy that land and own it, basically. And then, of course, the invader being the returning sibling. So there is a potential for equality there, but also I think a sort of sense that perhaps the natives have an upper hand, that they belong there, they were there first, that the whites are returning and were somehow disobedient, perhaps disowned, and are only now able to return.
When Winnemucca uses the word white in this book, is she referring to skin color?
Well, that's one of the interesting things that she does, is she often uses that word actually in different ways to take us away from the racial connotations that we normally would think of. And she describes, for example, at some points that the army members, some of them are not white. And she doesn't mean there that they're not white as in they're not racially white, but that they are honest. And so she uses as a slur another point that a woman who is really sort of dishonest and as cheating her is white. And so white becomes more of a sort of testament to one's behavior or a rendering of one's dishonest behavior rather than skin color. And there is a way that in some way, if you act honest and are true to your word, you can be not white and therefore be considered somehow more equal or better than the whites are.
And why would she use the word white in that way? Why not use another word, say, divide people up between immoral or moral people or people with integrity and people without?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'm not entirely sure. I think then as now, of course, she was sort of entering charged territory there by using those words. I think she's very conscious throughout about her critique. She also uses words like civilized and savage, and she uses a lot of sarcasm throughout the narrative in really phenomenal ways, sort of calling on people for being, she'll say in a very sarcastic tone, for being civilized and yet doing these really terrible things. So it's interesting. I mean, I think it's just part of the sort of edge that she has here, that she's not afraid to use these loaded words and to call them into question, and perhaps thinking there that she's going to stir up some controversy and question about those instead of shying away from them.
Well, here's another loaded term. Sarah Winnemucca refers to the U.S. president as Great Father, and you write that that term could be seen as reinforcing a kind of paternalism with which whites treated American Indians. But you suggest in this article there might be another way to interpret it.
I think going back to that kinship model, if we take that seriously, perhaps father is a word of respect at this point, rather than a sort of sense of natives as children, as less important or less privileged as the president might be. And I think the way that you can also look at that is that she refers to herself as mother when she's talking to her people, the Northern Paiutes. And she does that not, of course, as a sort of biological mother, but to establish a certain kind of position respect for herself. And so I think if she never used that sort of terminology for herself or for any other Native person, I think it would be harder to read it that way. But I think the way that she uses these kinship terms suggests that there is, it's all within that sort of model of we're all kin, we have relationships to each other that we need to live up to.
Yeah, and as you write, Winnemucca thought good people should be called father or mother regardless of race.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating way to, in some ways, get away from the sort of skin color, the very rigid biological sort of definition that we still have today that we tend to cling to, and in a way that, that Natives have often in the past, and even perhaps today in some ways, don't really believe in, that there has often in the past been a more kind of fluid idea of identity and adoptions across tribes and even adoptions of white people into Native tribes, so that those sort of ideas of your biological race, that your skin color is somehow all determinant and unchangeable, just don't always work for this Native literature.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. I'm CS. My guest joining us by phone from West Virginia is Carrie Carpenter. She is an assistant professor of English at West Virginia University. She's author of Seeing Red, Anger, Sentimentality, and American Indians. We are talking about an essay she contributed to the new volume, Racially Writing the Republic, and her essay is entitled Sarah Winnemucca and the Rewriting of Nation. Now, Sarah Winnemucca, in this book, Life Among the Paiutes, she, I don't know whether you'd say she speaks disparagingly of American Indians and Northern Paiutes in particular, but at one point she writes that, quote, my people are ignorant of worldly knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But what does she say her people are instead that might make up for that kind of ignorance?
Yeah, it's difficult to read some of the things in her book because they might strike us, especially today when we have a really active Native American literature canon, they might strike us as somehow being racist or a troubling representation of other Natives. But I think it's really important to consider the context. She wrote this knowing that few of her people would actually be reading it. She wrote it prominently for white women who she felt would be in a position to respond and be involved in legislation and things like that. So she was using sentimentality and rhetoric of that sort specifically because that's what she thought would be effective for her people. So some of that is the sort of the language of, oh, the poor, my poor people, even the language of her narrative, the title of it, Life Among the Paiutes, it almost sounds like an anthropologist talking about, writing about this distinct group that she's not a part of. And she, I think, is really using that language deliberately. So there are parts of that where she says things like, my people have no learning, they do not know about the history of the world. But she also has chapters that talk about the complexity of her culture, her tribe, and at one point she talks about how we have a republic as well as you. And she doesn't mean that somehow this ignorant, simplistic sort of culture in the sense that there is no redeeming quality or no learning. It's just that it may be seen that way, but that she actually has quite a bit of pride for the culture, and she describes in great detail in the book what the tribe was like before whites came and the so-called civilized people that really were causing a lot of trouble within the tribe. And so it seems in some ways troubling, but I think if you look at the larger context, it makes sense given her audience and what she was trying to do.
She goes on to write, and here I'm just reading something you cited. They are innocent and simple. These are the Paiutes. They are innocent and simple, but they are brave and will not be imposed upon. They are patient, but they know black is not white.
Right.
So they know something important here.
Right. And definitely, I think, have a sort of knowledge that she's crediting them for. And it's one of those spaces where, in some ways, you can read it as that kind of sentimental distancing language of those poor people. But on the other hand, because of all those parts in the book where she talks very proudly about her culture and the wonderful customs and things that they have, she's very clear that there is a line at which they won't allow to be crossed. And I think she thought, in some ways, her grandfather was a little naive in that he believed in this initial story of the return, and I think she struggles between wanting to accept that narrative but also seeing for herself a lot of the really troubling things that whites did to Native people. So really I see a struggle here in her trying to find a way to represent them in a noble way, but that's not the sort of simplistic kind of noble savage sort of narrative that was alive at the time.
And by story of the return, again, I know you mean the story told by Truckee, the grandfather of Sarah Winnemucca, of the Paiutes being originally composed of two dark and two white children. Then there was a vicious quarrel. Their parents insisted that they separate. And then Truckee, seeing whites arriving in the area in which he lived during the 1840s as the returning descendants of those white brothers, and that's why he said that was cause for a celebration as opposed to suspicion.
Right.
What does Winnemucca say or suggest about how egalitarian the Northern Paiute Republic was and how that compares with the U.S.?
She's very clear that amongst Paiutes that at least before colonization, there was quite a bit of equality between men and women. And as she says at one point, we have a republic as well as you. She says something along the lines of how our women can speak before the tribe, that there's a sense that in white culture, women don't have much of a space to speak or to really have any kind of legal authority, but that in Northern Paiute culture, that very much is the case. They do have that authority. And she uses some of that same language that would have been prominent at the time, talking about republic and that sort of thing, in a way to say that there is a equality there, that the nation exists, and in fact, perhaps even more equal than the U.S. is.
You go on to contend that Winnemucca's book, Life Among the Paiutes, published in 1883, can also be viewed as a direct challenge to the myth of the inevitable disappearance of the Indian. Tell us first about the contours of the myth.
Well, that's something that I come up against all the time in teaching, and that I think you can see anywhere in pop culture, the whole Last of the Mohicans, the narrative that there were tons of natives here, but then they were all wiped out. And that's a painful thing to hear if you're native or if you spend your life working on these texts, because of course you know very much that these cultures are alive and well. And I think it's part of what we call nostalgic imperialism, which is this idea that you can grieve for a people once you've defeated them. And there's a sense that we have all of these sort of narratives about how, oh, the poor Indians that were here and then we wiped them out. And that is inaccurate. So I always look in literature for those instances in which there is a real a kind of reappearance or a perseverance, and you can find that pretty easily when you look at Native literature, that it's still alive and well. And so I like to think of hers as one case of that, a time when the idea is that the so-called settling of the U.S. is occurring, and whites are somehow wiping out natives. And she's coming in and really making a wonderful statement for how natives have been there, they will be there. And I think the fact that even today there is a statue now of her in the U.S. Capitol shows how she is still and her people have still survived.
And at least some of Sarah Winnemucca's work back in the 1800s had to do, as we've been talking about, with translating and with mediating between whites and Indians. And one could say that as a translator or as a mediator, one is simply conveying something to someone else that someone else has said. In what ways do you think Sarah Winnemucca maintains her visibility despite having a job that might be seen as simply a serving as a conduit?
Well, one of the ways that I thought about was I used a theorist, Lawrence Venuti, who does a lot of work with translation studies and talks about how the ideal of translation has often been, at least to this point, that of course the translator is invisible, that a successful translation is one in which you don't even realize that there was someone mediating between the original text and the translation. And so there's a kind of disappearance that goes on. And so I wondered what it would mean to think of Sarah Winnemucca, who was, of course, an interpreter for much of her life. What would it mean to think of her as that sort of mediator who doesn't disappear? And there are instances in the book in which she talks about how at one point she was given a note to pass on, and she did not do that. She held on to it for a few days and then finally gave it up. And in some ways, I see that as a sort of resistance to that invisible translation, because of course, if you aren't complicit in translating that message, passing it on in some way, then you are really resisting that mode of making yourself invisible. And then there are other instances when she says, toward the end of the book, she talks about how she has been made to translate the white words, and they were lies, and so she refuses what would have been a really seamless translation of just translating what those words were. She actually says, this is what I've been told, and these are lies, and in doing so, really makes herself and Native Americans themselves present and visible there, that there isn't just a seamless sort of transaction of invisibility there.
What did Winnemucca do in the realm of advocacy and activism with some of the money she earned as an interpreter?
Well, she was able to do a lot of different things in terms of working with schools. She started a school, one of the reservations, and worked there, which is an interesting sort of exercise in trying to increase the literacy, English literacy of the Native children. She, as part of the book, included within it petitions that she hoped people would go ahead and sign and things that would get specific actions done. She was trying to do things like increase the food sources for people at the Yakima Reservation who were really starving to death. And there was concern about getting people to a kind of reservation that was actually had resources and getting the government to follow through with some of its promises. She gave many, many lectures across the Northeast and was very visible as a figure. She went to D.C. to try to get some help for her people and wasn't ultimately successful and had a lot of frustration in terms of finances throughout. She was never wealthy from her work as a translator, but she was at times able to support herself in ways that many natives were not.
Carrie Carpenter teaches English at West Virginia University. We're talking about her contribution to a new book, Racially Writing the Republic. You can find a link to that book as well as to her book, Seeing Red, Anger, Sentimentality, and American Indians, on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song. You pose a lot of important questions in this essay. It's entitled Sarah Winnemucca and the Rewriting of Nation. And one that I want to ask you, I want to turn one of your questions toward you. It goes like this. What would it mean for scholars of American studies to take seriously Winnemucca's vision of siblings reunited after an initial conflict?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's something that I would really hope that people would consider. I mean, I think that there have been certain narratives that have been told about the history of colonization, and they've been rather one-sided in terms of one group imposing itself upon another. And I think this kinship mode or model is not one that's been considered really that deeply, and I think it's significant that they are siblings that are reunited instead of a parent and child situation. So there's a sort of equality set up there. There's a lot of talk during the American Revolution of Britain as the parent, the colonies as the children, and then you see in a lot of the language as the revolution happens, increasingly colonists start talking about, like Thomas Paine, start talking about the colonists as brothers with Britain. And so I think there's a model there that exists for really understanding this more in terms of a kind of a rhetorical but also very meaningful strategy of understanding the equality between different cultures that we've seen before with things like the American Revolution.
Just a few minutes left with Carrie Carpenter, assistant professor of English at West Virginia University. You referred earlier to the myth of the inevitable disappearance of the Indian and how you liked the way in which Winnemucca's book challenged that myth. I think some of our listeners might still think that Native Americans make up a very insignificant proportion of the U.S. population and are on the decline or continue to be on the decline. What can you tell us concretely that would confront that kind of thinking?
I often ask this in classes. I start by asking people to guess at how many Native Americans are in the country and right now, and I almost always get low ball numbers. Some people say as few as 10,000, and I always have to sort of remind them that it depends on how you count, but basically 2.5 to 4 million. And again, that is obviously a smaller number given the whole population of the U.S., but that basically if you are in the midst of these cultures, they're very much alive and well. And I think it's just a matter of not looking hard enough. Or I think we often have a vision of, I often ask my students, tell me what a person would look like if an Indian person came in the classroom right now, what would that person look like? And they always say, well, this person would have feathers and this and that. And I often have to sort of get them to think about how many of them may have actually Native heritage and be even of Native descent or even members of a recognized tribe and don't look the part. They might have blue eyes, that sort of thing. And so there's a way that we just don't think that we're seeing Native people when in fact they are all around. They are surviving and in existence. It's a difficult thing to think about because we do deal with, in the class, often the classroom, we deal with questions about language, survival, things like that. And there are real issues that are out there in terms of the costs of sterilization attempts and the Holocaust of the 19th century in terms of disease and relocation and all of that. Those aren't things that we can forget about. But I think if we change our perceptions of what we're looking for, then we start to see far more Native Americans and Native American persistence than we would imagine.
Carrie Carpenter, she teaches English at West Virginia University, author of Seeing Red, Anger, Sentimentality in American Indians, which won honorable mention in the Gloria E. Anzaldúa Book Awards through the National Women's Studies Association. We've been talking about the essay she contributed to the new volume, Racially Writing the Republic, Racists, Race Rebels, and Transformations of American Identity, edited by Bruce Baum and Duchess Harris, and just out from Duke University Press. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, thank you very much.
And after a short music break, we'll present Andrea Smith talking about Indigenous knowledge in the context of anti-violence activism. Andrea Smith teaches in the Media and Cultural Studies program at the University of California, Riverside, and is the co-founder of INSIGHT, Women of Color Against Violence. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Noel Hanrahan is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. What have Native American women contributed to another key area of theory and activism, namely the anti-violence movement? Several years ago, Andrea Smith gave an address at the Historians Against War Conference. We'd like to present portions of that talk today. Smith is an assistant professor of media and cultural studies at UC Riverside. Her books include The Color of Violence, the INSIGHT Anthology, and Conquest, Sexual Violence and American Indian Genocide. Here is Andrea Smith speaking at the Historians Against War Conference at the University of Texas at Austin.
Much of this work came out of the anti-violence movement, particularly when folks became very disturbed after 9/11, when many mainstream feminist organizations actually supported Bush's bombing of Afghanistan because this was going to liberate the women from the repressive policies of the Taliban, because apparently if you throw bombs on women, it will liberate them. But nevertheless, kind of this position, it was what was consistent with a position that had been adopted by the anti-violence movement, which was that the state could somehow be the protector of women's freedom. So, for instance, the anti-violence movement had put all of its energies into one strategy for ending domestic and sexual violence, which was supporting the criminal justice system. Through the Violence Against Women Act, all these federal monies went into anti-violence agencies, which in turn invested themselves in calling for more police involvement, longer prison sentences, etc. And the notion was that state violence in the form of the criminal justice system was going to somehow protect women from domestic violence and sexual violence. The problematic assumption of this was that when we look at what was very disturbing to many people after 9/11 was the idea that somehow our notion of home and safety at home had been disrupted. There was the idea that terrorism happens somewhere out there, but our home is supposed to be a safe place. And yet what the anti-violence movement has always contributed to our analysis is that in fact it's our home where we're most likely to be in danger of violence. And in addition to that, the notion that real threat comes from a stranger somewhere out there stops us from seeing that the perpetrator most likely to hurt us is somebody in our own home. And similarly, the notion that terrorism happens somewhere out there stops us from seeing that the U.S. is in fact a country built on genocide, white supremacy, and violence against people. But nevertheless, while the anti-violence movement have contributed this important analysis, all its strategies devoted to ending violence were really based on the notion that the person we had to worry about was someone out there. And that's why it made sense from that perspective to invest in the criminal justice system, because that approach would make sense if what we needed to do was lock up a few wacko men. But when we have surveys in which half of the men say they would rape somebody if they thought they could get away with it, we would either have to arrest half the male population, which some may argue, but in reality is not feasible. So consequently, if we wanted a strategy that would transform a rape culture, we needed a different approach. So women of color argued that we needed to develop an analysis that looked at the intersections of state violence and interpersonal violence. Particularly, we saw this when we put Native women in the center of our analysis, because we see that it's through sexual violence that colonialism has been successful. That is, genocide is a process by which Indian people are not just killed, but by which colonizers attempt to kill our sense of even being a people. And in this process, Native peoples become seen as inherently impure and as a pollution from which the larger colonial body must always cleanse itself. To give an example of this, we can look at an Ivory soap commercial. And with a cartoonish figure of an Indian man and woman, this was the slogan that went with the commercial. It says, "We were once factious, fierce and wild, in peaceful arts unreconciled. Our blankets smeared with grease and stains from buffalo meat and settlers' veins. Through summer's dust and heat content, from moon to moon unwashed we went. But ivory soap came like a ray of light across our darkened way. And now we're civil, kind, and good, and keep the laws as people should. We wear our linen, lawn, and lace, as well as folks with paler face. And now I take, wherever we go, this cake of ivory soap to show what civilized my squaw and me and made us clean and fair to see." So, of course, the joke of this ad is that because Indian bodies can never be clean, white, they can never be clean. And in a patriarchal worldview, only the rape of bodies that are seen as pure count. So, for instance, the rape of sex workers is nothing anybody takes seriously, because sex workers are seen as inherently impure and hence inherently violable and rapable. And similarly, with the logic of genocide, colonialism has rendered Native bodies as inherently violable and, by extension, our lands inherently invadable. So therefore, when we look at the history of Native genocide, we see that sexual violence has been the primary strategy of the state, and it is quite unlikely then that the state is going to be the solution to ending violence within our communities. So consequently, women of color started to organize around a different approach to ending violence that would look at the links between gender violence and state violence. And they looked to approaches of community accountability, in which we would start to end violence in our communities without relying on the criminal justice system. So I just want to give a couple of models just to illustrate what's going on now. One such group is Communities Against Rape and Abuse, which held a prison abolition film festival as an anti-rape organization. And this was the promotional material that they put out. They said, "Any movement seeking to end violence will fail if its strategy supports and helps sustain the prison industrial complex. Prisons, policing, the death penalty, the war on terror, all increase rape, beatings, oppression, and death. As an anti-rape organization, we cannot support the funneling of resources into the criminal justice system to punish rapists and batterers, as this does not end violence. It only supports the same violence that views incarceration as a solution to complex social problems like rape and abuse. As survivors of rape and domestic violence, we will not let the anti-violence movement be further co-opted to support the mass criminalization of young people, immigrants and refugees, and the dehumanization of poor people, people of color, and people with disabilities. We support the anti-rape movement that builds sustainable communities on a foundation of safety, support, self-determination, and accountability." Another group in Brooklyn, New York, Sister to Sister, which is comprised of young women of color ages 13 and 18, decided to declare their area an autonomous zone, and they called it Sisters Liberated Ground. So instead of calling 911, essentially you call them. They've developed their own responses to violence using street theater, house visits, interventions, etc. They also started documenting police brutality against a young woman of color in their neighborhood, and then showed a film on it on the walls of the police station itself. So these are just a few of the models that people are working with. However, as this work started to develop, people realized that these community accountability models have more radical implications. And that happened in particular with the influence of indigenous people's theories about nationalism and sovereignty. That is, if you think about the criminal justice system, it's really the extension of a nation-state form of governance that's based on domination and control. So if you're trying to think of a world without prisons, then you have to think about, is there a whole different form of governance that we need that's not based on violence? And this is where we turn to Native peoples, who are arguing that there's an alternative vision that they can articulate around sovereignty, in which we would separate nation from nation state, and hence argue that an international struggle does not have to have as its end goal a nation state form of governance in which the elites rule everybody else through domination and coercion. But we can instead be informed by indigenous models of governance that are based on mutual responsibility and respect, and an understanding that we are part of a larger global world that we need to tend to. And in addition, we can rethink nation as not being about this ethnic cleansing, we're in, you're out, screw the rest of the world, but it's about being open in an inclusive way and sharing our responsibilities to keep, to maintain the world in a positive manner. So to give some theories about this that have been articulated by Native women activists, Crystal Echohawk describes it as, sovereignty is an active living process within this knot of human, material, and spiritual relationships bound together by mutual responsibilities and obligations. And Ingrid Wushinawatok argued that, quote, while sovereignty is alive and invested in the reality of every living thing for Native folks, Europeans relegated sovereignty to only one realm of life and existence, authority, supremacy, and dominion. In the indigenous realm, sovereignty encompasses responsibility, reciprocity, the land, life, and much more. And Sammy Tanita helps explain this by differentiating what she calls nationalism versus sovereignty. She says nationalism is saying, and she's talking about Native nationalism here, nationalism is saying our way is the only right way. But I think sovereignty is an acceptance of who and what's around you, and the nationalist doesn't accept that. Sovereignty is what you do and what you are with your own people, but there is a realization and acceptance there that there are others around you, and that happened even before Europeans came. We knew about the Indians, and we had alliances with some and fights with others, but part of the sovereignty was the acceptance that they were there. And I think it's very interesting that sometimes when we talk about sovereignty struggles, that the first question many non-Native people say is, are you saying we all have to go back to Europe or whatever? But the model that's being articulated, say by Lakota Hardin, is a much more inclusive vision. She describes sovereignty as about being for freedom for all peoples. She says, if it doesn't work for one of us, it doesn't work for any of us. The definition of sovereignty means that none of us are free unless all of us are free. We can't, we won't turn anybody away. How could we ever leave anyone behind? Now, in addition to this is, I think, having a gendered perspective on nationalism and the nation state, because what becomes clear is that the building block of a nation state is the heteropatriarchal family. And to elucidate this connection, we should turn to the Christian right. Charles Colson, with Prison Fellowship, explains this very clearly, as he explains why same-sex marriage leads to terrorism. Says, marriage is the traditional building block of human society, intended both to unite couples and bring children into the world. There is a natural moral order for the family. It is not a private institution designed solely for the individual gratification of its participants. If we fail to enact a federal marriage amendment, we can expect not just more family breakdown, but more criminals behind bars and more chaos in the streets. It's like handing moral weapons of mass destruction to those who would use America's decadence to recruit more snipers and hijackers and suicide bombers. And when radical Islamists see news coverage of same-sex couples being married in U.S. towns, we make our kind of freedom aberrant. We must preserve traditional traditional marriage in order to protect the United States from those who would use our depravity to destroy us. And providing further information on this connection was a World magazine which explained that the cause of the Abu Ghraib scandal was feminism. The reason is that because when women do not know their assigned role in the gender hierarchy, they will join the military and become disoriented and abuse prisoners. So, thus, as Anne Berlain argues in Lift High the Cross, it may be a mistake to argue that the goal of the Christian right is to create a theocracy in the U.S. She argues that the Christian right politics is operating through the private family, which is coded as white, patriarchal, and middle class, to create a, quote, Christian America. And she notes that this investment in the private family makes it difficult for people to invest in more public forms of social connection, and that this investment in the suburban private family serves to mask the public disinvestment in urban areas that makes the suburban lifestyle possible, and that the social decay that results is then construed as the result of deviance from the Christian family ideal rather than as the result of political and economic forces. She says, quote, the family is no mere metaphor, but a crucial technology by which modern power is produced and exercised. Now, as Jennifer Dennett-Dale and other Native activists argue, unfortunately, the response to kind of this heteropatriarchal Christian nationalism is often an equally heteronormative Native or racial justice nationalism. But what these women of color theorists are saying, however, is that any liberatory struggle that does not challenge heteropatriarchy cannot substantially challenge colonialism or white supremacy, because Charles Colson is correct that the colonial world order does depend on heteropatriarchy. Just as the patriarchs rule the family and police anybody who does not follow their gender roles, so too does a nation state form of governance rely on elites ruling everybody else and excluding those who are not properly members of the nation. So therefore, if we want a different model of organizing that does not have the heteropatriarchal family, we then start to construe a different model of liberation that's not based on a nation state form of governance. And this is what Native women are arguing. What are alternative forms of sovereignty that we can begin to organize for?
That was Andrea Smith, co-founder of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, and author of Native Americans and the Christian Right. She spoke at the Historians Against War conference on February 17th, 2006. I want to thank the LA Sound Posse for providing the audio of Smith's presentation. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And thanks to Noelle Hanrahan, who is at the controls today.